Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to Scram, the podcast passionate about the Scottish food and drink scene. I'm your host, Rosalind Erskine, and on this episode, I chat to wine expert, author, and TV personality, Oz Clark, and founder of Wine Event Scotland, and friend of this podcast, Diana Thompson. I'm joined by wine expert Oz Clark and friend of Scran, Diana Thompson from Wine Event Scotland. Feel like I can say that, Diana. We've talked quite a lot. How are you both?
Pretty well. I've been tasting wine solidly for about nearly 3 weeks now. So the idea of actually thinking about wine even is a bit disturbing to me. But I'm sure you're completely different. You're saying, isn't it wonderful? Well, I've got a glass of wine. Wait, oh, I can see one right behind you there, waiting for me as soon as I've finished. Well, perhaps I will.
Yeah, well, I can't. Well, hopefully you're okay to talk about wine, if not be sitting
drinking.
If I can
remember
wine.
How to pronounce the word, yes.
So, Oz, for anyone that doesn't know, and I obviously don't want to go into too much detail because we don't want to spoil your book that's just come out, how did you get into wine?
Oh, God. Well, we were having a picnic out on the River Ouse just near Cambridge when I was three, and my mother got the rug out and put the picnic all over it. My brother was drowning in the weir at the time. My father was trying to rescue him. My mother was having hysterics. And I just noticed that there was a bottle of my mother's homemade damson wine sitting over the one side. And I thought, well, nobody else is concentrating on me. Looks pretty attractive. So I drank it. That's how I started drinking wine. Actually, my brother did survive, you'll be pleased to know. My father dragged one bedraggled son out of the river and then looked at his other son, pink and comatose, and then saw the empty damson wine bottle. And he picked me up by the ankles and whacked me in the stomach. And all the damson wine sort of exited whence it had entered my person, which probably put me off drinking. I mean, literally, till about... I was about 18. I wasn't one of these people who wandered off at school and thought, how do I get to the pub? I'd had too many fuzzy memories of being three and drunk. But it did actually give me a long, long lasting pleasure in wines that taste of damsons, like one of the ones that I know that Edinburgh Uncorked is going to be having, Malbec from Argentina.
It's good to know it's not put you off then.
We lived out in the countryside. My parents didn't drink wine. Like, they drank two bottles of wine a year. And, you know, my dad was a doctor in the coal mines. It was perfectly normal not to drink wine. Nowadays, you think, well, in middle class, you'd be drinking wine. But we didn't. At the end of the 60s, 5% of the British nation drank wine. Now they reckon 85% do. It's a complete and total change. So coming from a non-wine drinking background was perfectly normal. And then I finally got up to university and with very little money in my pocket, but an enormous amount of enthusiasm for the gilded youth life of Evelyn Waugh and Max Beerbohm and all these people. I wanted to live that life that they lived without any money. And one of the things I discovered was that there was a university wine tasting club. And of course, university wine tasting club, it was subsidized, and it was £2 a term, and you got four tastings. That's 50 pence a tasting. I just thought, I shall become soigné and sophisticated and elegant and irresistible to the opposite sex if I'm a wine expert. So that's what I began. Oh, and then I remember, then of course I saw in the small print at the bottom that you could take a guest, and suddenly 50 pence a tasting became 50 pence a date. That's really how I got involved in wine tasting, looking for a cheap date.
And so you've said there that, you know, only 5% of people in the 60s drank wine, whereas now it's 85%. What was the main sort of driver of people getting into wine? Because, like, you're right, it does seem strange that people didn't really drink wine.
That's because wine was filthy. In the 60s and 70s, I think wine was probably disgusting. That's why I didn't drink it. We didn't have a popular wine culture in Britain because there wasn't any decent popular wine. The kind of scrapings from the bottom of the gut rot barrels of Southern Europe that we used to get plied with as ordinary wine drinkers. I mean, nobody would drink that stuff by choice. Nobody cared about what it tasted like. At the top end, you know, and they obviously Edinburgh knows this because Edinburgh and Leith have been one of the places in the 60s and 70s where you still could get a decent glass of wine. But the top end was still some lovely old-fashioned Bordeaux and ports and sherries and champagnes and things which people drank. But that was the tiny top end of society. Ordinary people like myself coming in as students or as young actors or whatever, that kind of thing. The kind of wine that we, A, could afford and B, were offered was muck. And it wasn't until there was one shining exception to that, Rioja, good old Rioja. Rioja actually gave us red wine without tears when the rest of Europe was trying to starve us of ripeness and had been doing so for 1,000 years. Rioja didn't. Rioja gave us that vanillary, that soft, that creamy, that coconutty, that gentleness. When most red wine would rip the insides of your tonsils off, Rioja wouldn't. Rioja would soothe your tonsils back into place. But what happened, and this would have been end of the 80s, the New World came along. And the New World had a completely different approach to wine to the Old World. I mean, the New World approach is the consumer matters. The New World approach is that the people who are drinking it, let's try and make them happy. And to the Old World, you thought, what? Why would we be trying to make these people happy? And the New World approach was, well, why wouldn't you? So you had people like Australia coming over and just giving you what they used to call sunshine in a bottle. And nowadays people say, oh, sunshine in a bottle. Oh, we're well past that. Well, they may be. A lot of people aren't well past that. The idea of nice ripe fruit and a white wine that tasted slightly peachy or apricotty or creamy or spicy and a red wine that tasted of lovely things like black currants and blackberries and ripe plums, those sort of, and a little bit of chocolate added on the top. Those sort of flavours. That's what Australia said. Yeah, of course we can do that. Why didn't you say so before? And it came. They came first. California came along at about the same time and could have done the same job as Australia. I think the thing about California was, though, that you know there are 300 plus million Americans all keen to drink Californian wines, and price and the dollar goes up and down like this in international terms. Australia, there aren't 300 million Australians. There aren't enough Australians to drink the kind of wine they were producing. They were desperate to export their stuff, but they like to drink decent stuff that tastes decent, and they don't put up with rubbish that doesn't taste any good. So they're ending up making too much wine over in Australia. They've got to export the stuff. And of course, the first place that they will ever think of exporting is to the old country, which was us. Now, it still wouldn't work because there used to be an Australian wine centre in Soho in London, and that was sort of it. It was the supermarkets who came along and had an open mind to saying, okay, we're looking for new stuff. They found Australia. They then found Chile. They then found New Zealand. They then found South Africa. Suddenly all of these are places who had either somewhere like New Zealand had no wine reputation at all, or somewhere like Chile had zero wine reputation in terms of export because they drank all the stuff they made anyway themselves. Same with Argentina. New Zealand virtually came and found us out with this complete new revelation, this revelatory wine called Sauvignon Blanc that the world had never seen. A wine like New Zealand's Sauvignon Blanc before, ever. That fresh, bright, fruity, crisp, gorgeously drinkable style. I mean, I often think with Sauvignon Blanc, you walk into a bar and you think, what should I have? A really good gin and tonic, a really nice pale ale, or a Sauvignon Blanc? It does the same job. You don't actually have to know much about Sauvignon Blanc. You just have to know it's always going to taste decent. It's always going to taste good. So you had Australia with that, those lovely round golden Australian Chardonnays. You had Australia. Australia pretty much taught Britain how to drink red wine. And it was literally wines like Penfolds. Penfolds is a big operation, but they made wines. There was a thing called Bin 28, a single wine, which you could get in every Oddbins shop and Majestics and all these places. The British learnt how to love red wine, not through France, not through Italy, not through Spain, but through Bin 28, Australian Shiraz. And Shiraz was ripe and rich in the mouth and juicy and spicy, and it warmed you up on these cold Edinburgh sort of old reeky evenings. There you were with a glass or two of Shiraz. You just felt so much better. Where did it come from? Australia. Where did what did it say on the label? Shiraz, Penfolds. Hey, what about all these complicated names? No. Just the grape is Shiraz. My name is Penfold. Australia, Chardonnay. The grape is Chardonnay. My name is, I don't know, Lindemann or Smith, or it doesn't matter. They basically said, what's the most important thing about the flavor of a wine? It's the grape variety. Now, this never happened before. It's Spain and Portugal and Italy and France. They didn't go around saying, hey, let's try and make it easy for the customer by saying the grape variety is what matters, because the grape varieties, they're the same as apples. If you give any of us here or any of our friends, give them a Cox's Orange Pippin and a Granny Smith and a Golden Delicious, everybody with their eyes shut will be able to tell you the difference. And it's the same with the Sauvignon is as different from a Chardonnay as a Granny Smith is different from a Cox's. I mean, hey, if you can tell the difference between a cup of tea and a haddock, you can probably wine taste. Basically, trying to teach wine tasting, we say, look, do it on your own terms. You don't have to go to school to learn it. You don't have to buy lots of books to learn it. If you just like the flavor of things and you just think, this is my palate, this is my sense of taste, this is my sense of smell, this is my hangover, it's just me, and I'll taste. We all have the same glass of wine. You, Roz, me, three of your friends, three of my friends, we have the same glass of wine. We'll probably all find slightly different flavors, and they're all the right flavors, because it's our set. We've got several million receptors up in our nasal cavity. That's where all these flavors develop. And you might, your nasal cavity might be really sensitive to apricots. Mine might be really sensitive to bananas. Another of your friends might be really sensitive to, I don't know, tangerines or something. So they will each pick up those sorts of flavors in their own particular way. And if somebody says it tastes of tangerines and somebody else says it tastes of lime zest, they're both right. There's no right and there's no wrong about it. Now, you can get as geeky as you like and you can learn. If you're excited about the difference in flavors and textures and smells, if you get excited, then there's lots of ways you can learn more. But you don't have to go any further. In a way, what's a good wine tasting note? You take a glass of wine and say, "Cool, lovely, what's next?" That's a perfectly good wine tasting note. It means you're happy, you smiled, you enjoyed what you had, you're looking for something else. Now, you could go on about the tastes of kelp and seaweed and burnt chocolate and mangoes and God knows what. And it might. And if you get a buzz out of that, that's great. And you could then say, this has spent 6 months in an oak barrel and 6 months in a concrete tank and 3 months in an egg and 2 months in a earthenware jar. Great, if that's what turns you on. The wonderful thing about wine is it's a fabulous pyramid there, and it goes to a thin point at the top, but as it gets to the bottom, it's a very wide pyramid. And anybody who just thinks, I feel like a glass of wine, has got as valid an opinion as someone like myself who spends half their time immersed in it.
Well, that's very interesting. I was going to say, you've talked there about wine tasting, and you've obviously been educating people on wine for a long time. I used to watch you with my mum on Food and Drink on the BBC, so it is really nice to be talking to you. How have you found that over the years? Do you find people now as engaged as they always have been? How are you finding sort of introducing new people to wine?
I think that far more people now have got far more ideas about wine. When we were doing food and drink, I forgot to mention my beloved Julie Goulden, who is an absolute superstar and very, very important in leading the whole British nation towards drinking wine, but always prepared to take a wine head on, completely regardless of reality, would then describe it in whatever way she wanted to describe it. And people all around Britain, 10, 12, 13 million people would clock in each week. And they used to go out to the shops and they couldn't say, oh, I feel like a bottle of Westhoffner Gerümpel Gewürztraminer, please. They just say, I'll have Gilly's wine. All around the nation, people would just go along next morning and the wines would sell out by lunchtime. Every wine that Gilly and I talked about on BBC Food and Drink would be sold out by lunchtime. And the supermarkets were always begging us to say, please give us 6 weeks' notice from what you're going to talk about. And we said, we can't, you know. This is virtually, as live, we were tasting it probably the day before we actually went out. No one in the wine world had ever talked to ordinary people before. The wine world had been very cloistered, and much of it still is, to be honest. But it was very, very cloistered. There was no populism of any sort. And what you needed to is try and translate some of the populism of people like Keith Floyd. And it's not easy because, of course, Keith Floyd goes out cooking, slurping back his wine as he goes, but cooking's fantastic fun to watch. Everyone's making stuff and cutting stuff and dropping stuff and boiling and frying and spicing. It's all, as many people have said, you know, cooking became the new rock and roll in probably the 1990s into the noughties. But wine is just a glass of liquid. You've got to make it all up as you go along. And when you're cooking, you are tasting fantastic things that actually taste of themselves. A shrimp tastes like a shrimp. Rosemary tastes like rosemary. Wine's got no language of its own at all. A glass of wine, you have to borrow language all the time to say what it tastes like. I can't pick up a glass and say to you, this tastes like Cabernet Sauvignon, because you're going to go, so? What does that mean? I have to say it tastes of blackcurrants, but not just raw blackcurrants. It tastes of blackcurrant jam. Hey, but not any blackcurrant jam. It tastes of my mum's blackcurrant jam. We used to have women with kids, and how do we have it? We cut a great slice of white bread. We slathered it with salted butter. We poured on my mum's blackcurrant jam, preferably the first jar of the first lot that she'd made this year. That's the smell and the taste of blackcurrants that I get. And then the blackberries are different. Again, not a raw blackberry particularly. It's more likely to be cooked blackberries, blackberry crumble, blackberry jelly, those sort of things. But I'm going back into my memory, into my life, drawing out memories and experiences, putting them into this glass, which is just called a glass of dark liquid called Cabernet Sauvignon. Glass of dark liquid called Cabernet Sauvignon is not going to make a single person want to drink wine. But also, the flavors weren't there until the New World came in, until Australia came in, until New Zealand came in, until South Africa, Chile, Argentina. They came in with flavors which were based on fruit, based on the grape variety. And again, each grape variety tastes different. So put it on the label. Make it easy. Malbec, you know, we've got to learn that. 10 years ago, nobody knew what Malbec was. Now, nearly everyone who drinks wine knows Malbec. It's simple. It's that grape that comes from Argentina, and you only need to know half a dozen. Chardonnay, that softer, more golden one. Sauvignon, that sharper, greener one. Pinot Noir, that lighter red one, sort of strawberry-ish. Shiraz, that round, rich, spicy one. Cabernet, that rather angular one, the one that makes you chew a bit in your mouth. I've mentioned five grape varieties, and you've already got as much knowledge as you need to know to have perfectly happy 12 months of wine drinking. And then you might think, well, what about countries? Australia's normally that it's hot in Australia, so hot things give you more tropical flavors. It'll be more peaches and more apricots and more things like kumquats, if anybody knows what a kumquat tastes like. More, you know, things like those orange melons rather than white melons. Those sort of flavors you get from Australia. New Zealand, it's colder. It's right, it's way down in the southern seas. It's pretty cold in the South Island, New Zealand. So then suddenly you're going into great flavors like green apples and greengages and kiwi fruit and limes. And those sort of things that just say, okay, I like that slightly cooler style of wine. I go to New Zealand. I like that slightly warmer style of wine. I go to Australia. Chile's a very interesting place because it's so long that you start in the Atacama Desert at the top and you end up virtually in Patagonia. So basically, Chile can offer you every possible type of wine, from big and rich and juicy and spicy to something really elegant and sort of refined and reserved. So that you're sort of looking into the wine thinking, I wonder what's there. Now, if you're thinking, I wonder what's there, that's not much good for someone who just wants to knock back a glass or two of white. That the job for them, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. No one does it better. But there are grapes like Riesling, which can grow down in Patagonia, in Chile. They also grow in France and Germany and places like that. Oh, and Australia, by the way. Of course, Australian Riesling, what does it taste like? It tastes about twice as strong as other people's Riesling. Why? Because it's made by Australians in Australia, and Australia does bigger flavors. Something like Riesling is a great... The wine geeks are always... trying to say, oh, Riesling is the next most famous grape. Everyone's going to love Riesling. Everywhere, it's going to become the new Chardonnay. Never does, because it's at heart, it's a wine geek's sort of style of wine. You have to work a bit at most Rieslings to think, what's there? That's not what most people want to do. They want what's there to be bang in your face like that. That's what Chardonnay does. That's what Sauvignon does. That's what Shiraz does. Merlot does that. Malbec. Pinot Noir, interestingly enough, doesn't. Pinot Noir demands a bit more thought, a bit more extra consideration. Therefore, Pinot Noir is more, it's a wine geek's grape. Merlot doesn't demand anything like the same intellectual approach. So that's everybody's grape.
You've mentioned all the wine varieties, the grape varieties and areas and things. What do you think the future of wine is, given global warming? And are you quite surprised that England is now producing wine?
I'm delighted England's producing. I'm not surprised at all, because I've sort of been in it. It's a wonderful, wonderful ride, English wine. And eventually, by the way, Scottish wine. You've had one or two attempts at Scottish vineyards. There's a fellow on Fife, somewhere over on the Tay, another chap on that, South African guy on the Tay. There's an experimental vineyard up in Aberdeenshire at the moment. It's 0.09 hectares, but it's growing all kinds of grape varieties, which can grow in places like the Baltic states and in Scandinavia. So they'd probably be okay in Scotland, because one forgets about Scotland is that the east side of Scotland is relatively dry. All you need is a bit more heat. If you look at Perthshire and going across to Fife and then up towards Aberdeenshire, there's lots of good market gardens, herbs. The herb industry is really good there. You produce wonderful herbs on the east side of Scotland there, just north of, I suppose, north of the Tay. What about Wales? They were saying, oh, Wales has got to be too cold, got to be too wet. Well, of course, most of Wales is too wet, but the reason that the rest of Wales isn't too wet is because most of Wales is great big mountains like that, and it's pouring with rain all the time, which means past those mountains, there are going to be valleys where the sun shines all the time. I was in the Conwy Valley last summer and in the Vale of Denbigh, which is just further along. Each time I was standing in bright sunshine, tasting, by the way, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir wines. In other words, wines that you think, oh, those are classic French grape varieties. Surely it'll be far too cold in Wales to ripen those, because they need more sunshine. It's not. Not in years like 2020. Not in years like 2022. You've got ample sunshine in somewhere like Wales. Not everywhere. In some parts of Wales. Yorkshire has now got 25 different vineyards. Yorkshire has got a vineyard trail. That's wine tourism. That's the kind of thing they have in Champagne or in Burgundy. Nope, Yorkshire's got a vineyard trail. And when it comes to what's happening in the south of England, the thing about the south of England is we've got basically the same geology as the Champagne region, which is based on Cretaceous chalk, all those wonderful white chalk cliffs. That's exactly the same soil as they grow the best champagnes on. And Champagne is an area northeast of Paris. It's only 2 hours drive from Calais. And so the white cliffs of Calais are exactly the same as the Champagne soil. And the white cliffs of Calais are exactly the same as the white cliffs of Dover. So it all over southern England, you've got the same basic soil as Champagne. And that runs up to north of the Humber, So if you're in places like just north of Hull, you've got the same soil as Champagne. If you're in Norfolk, you've got the same soil as Champagne. The Champagne is like there. You just go round a bit like that. You've gone to Chablis. Chablis is a cough and a spit away from Champagne. Now, Chablis is basically a slightly different soil, limestone rather than chalk, but pretty similar. And that runs all the way up from Dorset, up to the Midlands, up to Middlesbrough. And that, in the next 5 or 10 years, we're going to find that exploited more and more and more, right the way up to something like Middlesbrough.
And we can keep everything crossed for a Fife wine as well.
I'm sure Fife will work. The dear old Charlie Trotter, I think his name was, the chap. You know, he had a go, and he's just a generation too early. If you can grow and ripen all those soft fruits all the way in places like Perthshire and along the Tay, if you can do soft fruits, just a little bit more heat, you'll be able to do grapes, because grapes have got much better protection against the diseases of dampness than something like a raspberry or a strawberry has.
So I'm going to just bring Diana in, because since we're talking about Scotland and wine, and you are going to be hosting Edinburgh Uncorked, Oz, you'll be there, which is next month. Is that right? Do you want to just tell us a bit about it, Diana, and then we can talk to Oz about what he's doing?
Thank you. So Edinburgh Uncorked with Oz Clark is a fantastic wine fair that's taking place on Saturday the 3rd of June. There are two sessions to choose from. You can come from 12 till 3 or 4 till 7. And we've got 35 producers there who are literally showing wines from all over the world. They're each showing at least 6 wines, so you can do the maths of how many hundreds of wines we're going to have. But there's going to be ones that you will have seen before, so you can revisit those, ones you can explore and discover for yourself. And it's going to be a fantastic day out.
Diana, that's fantastic. I mean, over 200 wines. I mean, those of you who haven't been to a wine fair before, you really should come along, because it's fantastic fun. And where else can you go in and say, I've got 200 wines today, where do I start? All I can say is, don't waste time. Get there early, use your 3 hours, and you'll be absolutely amazed, A, how much fun you have, and B, how much you can learn if you want to. And if you just want to have a good time with your friends, well, you can do that too.
That's right. It's the assembly room.
Assembly rooms. God, I did a show there once with a group called Morris Minor and the Majors. And I think Donovan was there as well. God, that'll show you a few years ago.
And Diana, did it come from a sort of similar vein of wanting to just inform people about wine? Like, what was the sort of thinking behind it all?
Yes, absolutely. So I started a Facebook page, which is Edinburgh Uncorked, and it's obviously there today. And the idea was that if people are out, they find a wine that they like, take a photo of it and pop it on Edinburgh Uncorked and tell people where you can get it. Or if you're in the supermarket, you see a wine you like, or something special offer, take a photo, tell people about it. And it's the idea, it's great wines at great prices. And that's exactly what we're talking to the producers about, choosing the wines that they're going to show. They've all got to be great wines at great prices. So whatever level, whether it's entry level or whether it's top end, they're showing great value for money and they're great wines.
And you can buy them on the day, can't you?
Yes, a lot of the producers will be selling on the day, or you can place orders and there'll be special offers galore.
But just tell me, when I buy my ticket, I then go in, I've got my ticket, and for the next 3 hours, I can taste whatever I want. I don't have to pay again.
Absolutely. No, you come in and your ticket, so tickets are from £25. If there's 4 of you, it's £25 each. If you're just on your own or a couple of you, it's £30. And you can taste as much as you like and talk as much as you like to the producers there.
So do the math. Do the math. To use an Americanism.
And we're going to be announcing masterclasses soon as well. So there'll be 2 masterclasses per session to choose from as well. So that'll be
fun. I mean, if you feel like, okay, let's do some serious wine tasting, masterclasses are good fun, because you get real experts coming in and saying, okay, I've got a bunch of people who actually want to know about the terroir and the grape varieties and the way that the winemakers behave and all this kind of thing. So they're fantastic for those on the next rung up. But those of you who don't want to go to that next rung up, stick around on the floor and taste another 50 wines.
Well, sounds great, especially on a weekend in June when hopefully there's nice weather and we can all get a rosé.
Rosalind's only 2 weeks off Midsummer Night.
Or Dawn.
So in other words, once we've finished Edinburgh and Cork, there'll be another hour or two of sunshine for you to go and get your bottle of rosé and sit out in the sunshine and think, I've had a really good time at Edinburgh and Cork. And you've probably made about 10 new friends as well.
We've also written a blog, if people are interested, which you can find on the booking page, if you're coming to Edinburgh, of things you can do in Edinburgh. So it's like that. After the show, why don't you go to Prince Street Gardens and enjoy a glass of rosé? Or why don't you go to Harvey Nichols beforehand and have brunch just to set you up?
Good.
And we also have a wonderful, the Edinburgh Food Safari. Nell Nelson, she's going to be doing a food tour the following day as well.
That'll be brilliant.
Yeah, sounds good. And finally, if you could only take three drinks onto a desert island, what would they be and why?
I think it would be a perfectly brewed, perfectly drawn pint of an old-fashioned 80 Bob Natural of the kind that Stuart's were brewing for a while in Edinburgh. And that long, long ago you used to get from Younger's, or even better, you used to get them from, Lorimer and Clark. And there are a few people who will remember Lorimer and Clark. It was a wonderful brewery, which eventually, I think it was somewhere down just near Haymarket, the brewery. But Lorimer and Clark's Pale Ale, you have to be 105 years old to know what I'm talking about. It would be a perfectly balanced pint of really properly brewed beer, which I would take.
Diana, what would be your three drinks that you take on a desert island? Or a drink?
I'll take a couple. I think some sparkling wine, and it doesn't need to be champagne. It could be fantastic Cap Classique from South Africa, or just sparkling wine from Australia. And a second one, I think, after us talking about Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, I think a little bit fresh Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand.
And if you had to say to me, Roz, one wine that I think I would take, it would be a really nice fresh Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand for my desert island wine.
I feel like now we're all going to finish up and have a nice fresh glass of Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, well, I've got one back there. Maybe it's time I tried it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much, both. It's been great to chat and find out more about wine and the event. And just quickly, for anyone who wants to get tickets, what's your website, Diana?
It's wineeventscotland.co.uk or on social media at wineeventsscot.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I hope it goes well, and we'll see you there.
Fantastic, thank you.
See you then.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks to Oz and Diana for being my guests on this episode. Edinburgh and Cork sounds like a fabulous event, and I'm sure we're now all craving a chilled glass of Sauvignon Blanc. Thanks to you too for listening. Please remember to rate, review and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Scran is a laudable podcast that's co-produced and hosted by me, Roz and Erskine, and co-produced, edited and mixed by Kelly Crichton.